is about to begin, and we are about to win it. Extempore speech given by General Potter to the Chaos Legion immediately before their first battle on November 3rd, 1991, at 2:56 p.m.
My troops, I'm not going to lie to you. Our situation today is very grim. Dragon Army has never lost a single battle, and Hermione Granger has a very good memory. The truth is, most of you are probably going to die, and the survivors will envy the dead. But we have to win this. We have to win this so that someday our children can enjoy the taste of chocolate again. Everything is at stake here. Literally everything. If we lose, the whole universe just blinks out like a light bulb. And now I realize that most of you don't know what a light bulb is. Well, take it from me. It's bad. But if we have to go down, let's go down fighting, like heroes, so that as the darkness closes in, we can think to ourselves, at least we had fun. Are you afraid to die? I know I am. I can feel those cold shivers of fear, like someone is pumping ice cream into my shirt. But I know that history is watching us. It was watching us when we changed into our uniforms. It was probably taking pictures. And history, my troops, is written by the victors. If we win this, we can write our own history. A history in which Hogwarts was founded by four renegade house elves. We can make everyone study that history, even though it isn't true. And if they don't answer the right way on our tests, they'll fail the class. Isn't that worth dying for? No, don't answer that. Some things are better left unknown. None of us know why we're here. None of us know why we're fighting. We just woke up in these uniforms in this mysterious forest, knowing only that there was no way to get our names and memories back except victory. The students in those other armies out there, they're just like us. They don't want to die. They're fighting to protect each other, the only friends they have left. They're fighting because they know they have families who'll miss them, even if they can't remember now. They may even be fighting to save the world. But we have a better reason to fight than they do. We fight because we like it. We fight to amuse eldritch monstrosities from beyond space and time. We fight because we are chaos. Soon, the final battle will begin. So let me say now, because I won't get a chance later, that it was an honor to be your commander, however briefly. Thank you. Thank you all. And remember, your goal isn't just to cut down the enemy. It's to make them afraid.
A great booming gong echoed over the forest, and the Sunshine Regiment began to march. The tension rose, and rose as Harry and the 19 other soldiers who remained waited for the aerial warriors to report back. It shouldn't take long. Broomsticks were fast, and the distances in the forest were not great. Two broomsticks approached, at speed, from the direction of Draco's camp, and all the soldiers tensed.
They weren't executing the manoeuvres that were today's code for a friendly broomstick.
"Scatter and fire!"
roared General Potter, and then suited action to words, scurrying off at top speed toward the forest cover. And then, as soon as Harry was among the trees, he spun back, raised his wand, tried to seek out the broomstick in the sky.
"Clear!"
shouted a voice.
"They're heading back!"
Harry gave a mental shrug. There'd be no way to prevent Draco from obtaining that information, and he'd only learned that they'd been standing still. And the Chaotix slowly emerged from the forest.
"Broomstick, approaching from Granger's direction!" yelled another voice. "I think it's Greenleader! He did the dip and roll!"
Moments later, Theodore Knott dived out of the sky and pulled up in the midst of the soldiers.
"Granger has divided our forces in two!"
yelled Knott as he hovered on his broomstick. There was sweat staining his uniform, and all the reserve was gone from his voice.
"She's attacking both armies! Two brooms covering each force! They pursued me halfway here!"
"Divided her army? What on earth?"
A large force, concentrating fire on a small force, could deplete that force rapidly without taking much damage in return. If 20 soldiers faced 10, 20 sleep spells would be aimed at the 10 soldiers, with only 10 sleep spells going the other way, so unless every one of those first sleep spells hit its target, the smaller force would lose more people than they could manage to take down with them. Defeated in detail was the military term for what happened when you divided your forces like that. What could Hermione possibly be thinking? Then Harry realized.
She's being fair.
It was going to be a long year in defense class.
"All right,"
Harry said loudly so the army could hear.
"We'll wait until the Red Wing reports in, and then we'll go cloud up some sunshine."
Draco listened to the flyer's reports with his face calm, all his shock concealed inside. What could Granger possibly be thinking? Then Draco realized.
It's a feint!
One of Sunshine's two forces would change direction, and both would converge on... who? Neville Longbottom marched through the forest toward the approaching sunny force, occasionally glancing up at the sky for broomsticks. Beside him marched his squad comrades, Melvin Coote and Lavender Brown of Gryffindor, and Alan Flint of Slytherin. Alan Flint was their squad suggester, though Harry had first said to Neville, in private, that the position was his if he wanted it. Harry had said quite a lot of things to Neville in private, starting with,
"You know, Neville, if you want to become as awesome as the imaginary Neville who lives in your head but isn't allowed to do anything because you're scared, then you really should sign up for Professor Quirrell's armies."
Neville was now sure the boy who lived could read minds. There was just no other way Harry Potter could have known. Neville had never talked about that with anyone, or given any sign, and other people weren't like that, not that Neville had ever noticed. And Harry's promise had come true. This did feel different from sparring in defense class. Neville had hoped that sparring would fix everything that was wrong with him, and, well, it hadn't. Even if he could fire a few spells at another student in class with Professor Quirrell watching to make sure nothing went wrong, even if he could dodge and fire back when it was allowed, and everyone else was expecting it, and they would stare at him funny if he didn't do it, none of that was the same as being able to stand up for himself. But being part of an army... Something strange was stirring inside Neville as he marched through the forest alongside his comrades.
upon their uniforms, an insignia of fingers poised to snap. He was allowed to walk if he wanted to, but he just felt like marching. Beside him, Melvin and Lavender and Alan all seemed to feel like marching too. And Neville softly began to sing the Song of Chaos. The tune was what a muggle would have identified as John Williams' Imperial March, also known as Darth Vader's theme, and the words Harry had added were easy to remember. Doom, 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 doom. By the second line, the others had joined in, and soon you could hear the same soft chant coming from nearby parts of the forest. And Neville marched alongside his fellow Chaos Legionnaires, strange feelings stirring in his heart, imagination becoming reality. And from his lips poured a fearful song of doom. Harry stared at the bodies scattered across the forest. Something inside him felt a bit queasy, and he had to remind himself hard that they were only sleeping. There were girls among the fallen, and that made it a lot worse somehow, and he would have to be careful never to mention that in front of Hermione, or the Aurors would find his remains stuffed into a small teapot. Half of Sunshine Army hadn't put up much of a fight against all of Chaos. The 9 ground soldiers had run in, screaming inarticulately with simple shields raised, circular screens to protect their faces and chests. But you couldn't fire and hold the shield at the same time, and Harry's shoulders had simply aimed for the legs. All but one of the Sunnies had fallen over as soon as the cries of "Somnium!" filled the air. That last one had dropped her shield and managed to take out one of Harry's soldiers before being hit by the second wave of sleep spells. The sleep hex was safe from multiple hits. The 2 Sunny broomsticks had been much harder to take down and had accounted for 3 chaotics before being aura'd by mass groundfire. Hermione wasn't among the fallen. Draco must have gotten her, and that was making Harry feel angry on some completely incomprehensible level. He wasn't sure if he was feeling protective toward Hermione, or cheated that he hadn't been the one to do it. Or maybe both.
"All right," Harry said, raising his voice. "Let's everyone be clear on one thing. That wasn't a real fight. That was General Granger making a mistake in her first battle. Today's actual fight is with Dragon Army, and it's not going to be anything like this. It's going to be a lot more fun. Let's move out."
A broomstick fell out of the sky, approaching terrifyingly fast, and spun on its end and decelerated so hard you could almost hear the air screaming in protest, and came to a halt directly beside Draco. It wasn't dangerous showing off. Gregory Goyle simply was that good, and he didn't waste time.
"Potter's coming,"
Gregory said with no trace of his usual fake drawl.
"They've still got 4 of their brooms. You want me to take them out?"
"No,"
Draco said sharply.
"Fighting over their army gives them too much of an advantage. They'll fire on you from the ground, and even you might not be able to dodge it all. Wait until the forces engage."
Draco had lost 4 dragons in exchange for 12 Sunnies. Apparently, General Granger actually had been that incredibly stupid, though she hadn't been among the attackers, so Draco hadn't gotten a chance to taunt her or ask her what in Merlin's name she'd been thinking. The true battle, they all knew, would be with Harry Potter.
prepare yourselves!" roared Draco at his troops. "Stay together with your mates. Act as a unit. Fire as soon as the enemy is in range."
Discipline against chaos. It shouldn't be much of a fight. The adrenaline was pumping and pumping into Neville's blood until he felt he could hardly breathe.
"We're closing in,"
said General Potter in a voice barely loud enough to carry to the whole army.
"Time to spread out."
Neville's comrades moved away from him. They would still support each other, but if you clustered together, the enemy would have a much easier time hitting you. Fire aimed at one of your comrades might miss and get you instead. You'd be a lot harder to hit if you spread out and moved as fast as you could. The first thing General Potter had done during their training session was get them to fire on each other when both sides were running fast, or both stood still and took time to aim, or one was moving and one was standing still. The reverse charm to the simple hex was simple, though you weren't allowed to use it during real battles. General Potter had carefully recorded everything that happened, done some figuring and ciphering, and then announced that it made more sense for them to focus not on slowing down to aim carefully, but on moving fast so they wouldn't get hit. It still bothered Neville a little not to be marching side by side with his comrades, but the scary battle cries they'd learned were already thundering in his head, and that made up for a lot. This time, Neville silently vowed to himself. His voice was absolutely, positively, not going to squeak.
"Shields up," said General Potter. "Power to forward deflectors."
"Contigo,"
murmured the army, and the circular screens sprang into existence before their heads and chests. A sharp taste filled Neville's mouth. General Potter wouldn't have ordered them to cast shields unless they were almost in range. Neville could see the uniformed shapes of dragons moving through the dense screens of trees, and the dragons would be seeing them as well.
"Attack!"
came a cry from the distance, the voice of Draco Malfoy, and General Potter bellowed,
"Charge!"
All the adrenaline in Neville's blood was unleashed, and his legs took over, sending him flying faster than he'd ever run before, straight toward the enemy, knowing without needing to look that all his comrades were doing the same.
"Blood for the Blood God!" screamed Neville. "Skulls for the Skull Throne! La Shub Niggurath! The enemy's gate is sideways!"
There was a soundless impact as a sleep spell wasted itself against Neville's shield. If there'd been other spells fired, they hadn't hit. Neville saw the look of fear on Wayne Hopkins's face as he stood beside two Gryffindors Neville didn't recognize. And then Neville dropped the simple shield and fired at Wayne. Missed. His racing legs went straight past the enemy grouping and toward another three dragons, their wands coming up on him, their mouths opening. Not even thinking about it, Neville dived down to the forest floor just as three voices cried,
"Somnium!"
It hurt, hard stones and hard twigs digging into Neville as he rolled. It wasn't as bad as falling off his broomstick, but he'd still hit the ground pretty hard. And then Neville, with sudden insight, lay still and closed his eyes.
"Stop that!" screamed a voice.
"Don't shoot us! We're dragons!"
With a flash of glorious satisfaction, Neville realized that he'd managed to get between two groups of dragons, just as one group had fired on him. Harry had talked about this as a tactic for making the enemy afraid to fire. But apparently it worked a bit better than that. And not only that, the dragons believed they'd gotten him, since they'd seen Neville fall just as they fired. Neville counted to 20 inside his head, then opened his eyes a crack. The three dragons were very near him, heads spinning rapidly as cries of "Somnium!" and "Skulls for the Skull Throne!" filled the air around them. All three had simple shields up now. Neville's wand was still in his hand, and it didn't take much effort to point it at one boy's boots and whisper, "Somnium!" Neville quickly closed his eyes and relaxed his hand as he heard the boy fall to the ground.
"Where did it come from?"
screamed Justin Finch Fletchley's voice, and Neville heard rustles on the leafy forest floor, as of two dragons spinning around, looking for an enemy.
"Reform ranks!" bellowed Malfoy's voice. "To me, everyone! Don't let them scatter you!"
Neville's ears heard the two dragons actually jump over his prone body as they ran off. Neville opened his eyes, pushed himself to his feet, a bit painfully, and then pointed his wand and said the new charm that General Potter had taught them all. They couldn't do real illusion spells to confuse the enemy, but even at their age they could...
"Ventriloquo,"
whispered Neville, pointing the wand to one side of Justin and the other boy, and then yelled,
"The Cthulhu and glory!"
Justin and the other boy stopped abruptly, turning their shields toward where Neville had moved his battle cry, and that was when multiple cries of
"Somnium!
Somnium!
Somnium!"
filled the air, and the other boy dropped before Neville was finished aiming.
"The last one's man!"
yelled Neville, and then he started sprinting straight toward Justin, who'd been mean to him until the older Hufflepuff straightened him out. Neville was surrounded by his comrades, and that meant...
"Special attack! Chaotic leap!"
howled Neville as he ran, and felt his body lighten, then lighten twice again as his comrades got their wands turned toward him and quietly cast the hover charm. And Neville raised his left hand and snapped his fingers, and then used his legs to push off the ground as hard as he could and soared through the air. Sheer shock painted Justin's face as Neville went over the other boy's shield and pointed his wand down at the form passing beneath him and cried,
"Somnium!"
Because it felt like it. That was why. Neville didn't quite get his feet turned around properly, and rather ploughed into the ground as he landed. But two out of three of the other Chaos Legionnaires had managed to hold their wands on him throughout, and he didn't hit very hard. And Neville got to his feet, panting. He knew he should be moving. People were yelling, "Somnium!" all over the place.
"I am Neville, the last scion of Longbottom!"
screamed Neville to the sky above, holding his wand pointed straight up as though to challenge the blazing blue heaven itself, knowing that nothing after this day would ever be the same again.
"Neville of Chaos! Face me if you d—"
When Neville woke up afterward, he was told that Dragon Army had taken this as their cue to counterattack. The girl beside Harry slumped to the ground. Taking the shot meant for him, and he could hear Mr. Goyle's distant gloating laugh as his broomstick blasted past them, cutting the air so hard it could have shattered in his wake.
"Lumos!"
cried one of the boys next to Harry, who hadn't been able to rebuild the magical strength fast enough to do it earlier, and Mr. Goyle dodged it without a pause. Chaos had only 6 soldiers left now, and Dragon Army had 2, and the only problem was that one of those soldiers was invincible, and the other one was using up 3 soldiers just to cover him inside his shield. They'd lost more soldiers to Mr. Goyle than all the other dragons put together,
He was weaving and dodging through the air so fast that no one could hit him. And he could shoot people while he did that. Harry had thought of all sorts of ways to stop Mr. Goyle, but none of them were safe. Even using the hover charm to slow him down, it was a continuous beam and much easier to aim, wouldn't be safe because he might fall off the broomstick. Throwing things in his way wouldn't be safe, and that was getting harder and harder to remember as Harry's blood froze over.
It's a game. You're not trying to kill him. Don't throw away all your future plans for a game.
Harry could see the pattern. He could see how Mr. Goyle was weaving. He could see how and when they all needed to fire in order to create a web of shots that Mr. Goyle wouldn't be able to dodge. But he just hadn't been able to explain it fast enough to his soldiers. They couldn't coordinate their shots well enough, and now they didn't have enough people left to do it.
I refuse to lose. Not like this. Not my whole army to one soldier.
Mr. Goyle's broomstick turned faster than anything should have been able to turn and started to angle in toward Harry and his surviving troops. He could sense the boy beside him tensing, getting ready to throw himself in front of his general.
Screw this!
Harry's wand came up, focusing on Mr. Goyle. Harry's mind visualized the pattern, and Harry's lips opened, and his voice screamed,
Luminous, 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 luminous!
When Harry's eyes opened again, he found himself resting in a comfortable position with his hands folded over his chest, holding his wand like a fallen hero. Slowly, Harry sat up. His magic was aching. A strange sensation, but not an entirely unpleasant one. Much like the burn and lethargy that followed hard physical exercise.
The general's awake!
Cried a voice, and Harry blinked and focused in that direction. Four of his soldiers held their wands on a shimmering, prismatic hemisphere, and Harry realized that the battle wasn't over. Right. He hadn't been hit by a sleep hex, just exhausted himself. So, when he woke up, he was still in the game. Harry suspected he was going to get a lecture from someone or other about not exhausting his magic to the point of unconsciousness over a children's game. But he hadn't hurt Mr. Goyle when he'd lost his temper, and that was the important thing. Then Harry's mind clicked on another implication, and he looked down at the steel ring on his left hand's pinky finger, and almost swore out loud when he saw that the tiny diamond was missing, and there was a marshmallow lying on the ground near where he'd fallen. He had sustained that transfiguration for 17 days, and would now need to start over. Could have been worse. He could have done this 14 days later, after Professor McGonagall had approved him to transfigure his father's rock. That was one very good lesson to learn the easy way.
A note to self. Always remove ring from finger before completely exhausting magic.
Harry pushed himself up, making rather hard going of it. Using up your magic didn't exhaust your muscles, but dodging around trees certainly did. He staggered over to the iridescent hemisphere that contained Draco Malfoy, who was holding his wand aloft to sustain the shield, and smiling coldly at Harry.
"Where's the fifth soldier?"
said Harry.
"Oh,"
said a boy whose name Harry couldn't remember at the moment.
Oh, I fired a sleep hex at the shield, and it bounced off and hit Lavender. I mean, the angle shouldn't have been right, but it did.
Draco was smirking inside the shield.
So, let me guess,
Harry said, looking Draco directly in the eyes.
Those neat little trios are the formation used by professional magical militaries, made up of trained soldiers who can easily hit moving targets if their own hands are steady, and who can combine their defensive powers so long as they stay together. Unlike your soldiers.
The smirk had vanished from Draco's face, which was now hard and grim.
You know,
Harry said lightly, knowing that none of the others would understand the real message passing between them.
It just goes to show that you should always question everything you see your role models doing, and ask why it's being done, and whether it makes sense in context for you to do it too. Don't forget to apply that advice to real life, by the way. And thanks for the slow-moving clustered targets.
Because Draco had already gotten that lecture, and Harry suspected, discounted it out of suspicion that Harry was trying to shift his loyalties further away from pure blood tradition, which of course Harry was. But this example would make an excellent excuse next Saturday to claim that questioning authority was a merely practical technique for real life. And Harry would also mention the experiments he'd run, first with individuals and then with groups, to check that his ideas about the importance of speed had actually been correct, by way of hammering home the point of Draco needing to keep an eye out at all times for chances to apply the methods in everyday practice.
"You haven't won yet, General Potter," snarled Draco. "Maybe we'll run out of time, and Professor Quirrell will call it a draw."
A fair and worrisome point. The war only ended when Professor Quirrell, in his personal judgment, decided one army had won by practical, real-world standards. There was no formal victory condition, Professor Quirrell had explained, because then Harry would figure out how to game the rules. Harry had to admit this was a fair cop. And Harry couldn't blame Professor Quirrell for not calling an end, because it was plausible that the last soldier of Dragon Army could take out all five survivors of the Chaos Legion.
"All right," Harry said. "Does anyone know anything about General Malfoy's shield spell?"
It developed that Draco's shield was a version of the standard Protego, which had several disadvantages. The most important of which was that the shield couldn't move with the caster. The upside, or from Harry's perspective, downside, was that it was easier to learn, easier to cast, and much easier to sustain for long times. They would need to hammer the shield with attack spells in order to bring it down. And Draco could apparently exert some control over the angle of reflection at which the spells would bounce off. The thought occurred to Harry that they could use Wingardium Leviosa to pile up heavy rocks on the shield until Draco couldn't sustain it against the pressure, but then the rocks might fall in afterward and hit Draco, and injuring the enemy general for real was not among today's goals.
So, said Harry, are there such things as specialized shield-piercing spells?
There were. Harry asked if any of his soldiers knew them. No one did. Draco was smirking again, inside his shield. Harry asked if there was any sort of attack spell that wouldn't bounce. Lightning bolts, it seemed, were usually absorbed by shields instead of bouncing off them. No one knew how to cast any sort of lightning-related spell. Draco sniggered. Harry sighed. He quite deliberately laid his wand on the ground. and Harry announced, with some weariness in his voice, that he would just go ahead and take down the shield himself, using some method that would remain mysterious, and everyone else was to fire on Draco as soon as his shield went down. The Chaos Legionnaires looked nervous. Draco looked calm, which was to say, controlled. A thin, folded blanket came out of Harry's pouch. Harry sat down next to the shimmering shield and pulled the blanket over his head so no one could see what he did, except Draco, of course. From Harry's pouch came a car battery and a set of jumper cables. It wasn't like he'd been about to leave the Muggle world to start a new era of magical research and not take along any way of generating electricity. Shortly after, the Chaos Legionnaires heard the sound of fingers snapping, followed by a crackling noise from beneath the blanket. The shield started glowing more brightly, and Harry's voice said,
"Don't be distracted, please. Eyes on General Malfoy."
The strain was showing on Draco's face, along with the fury and annoyance and frustration. Harry smiled up at him and mouthed,
"Tell you later."
And that was when a spiral of green energy shot out of the forest and smashed into Draco's shield, which shrieked like pieces of sharp glass being rubbed together, and Draco staggered. In sudden, frantic panic, Harry took the jumper cables off the battery and fed them into the pouch. Then he fed the battery itself into the pouch, and then he tore off the blanket and grabbed his wand and stood up. All of his soldiers were still there and glancing around frantically.
"Contago!"
Harry said, and his soldiers followed suit. But Harry didn't even know which direction the shield ought to be pointing in.
Did anyone see where that came from?
Shaken heads.
And General Malfoy, would you mind telling me if you got General Granger?
Why, yes, Draco said acidly. I mind.
Oh, hell.
Harry's mind began calculating. Draco inside the shield. Draco worn out now to some degree. Harry worn out too. Hermione in the woods, who knew where. Harry and four other Chaotics left.
"You know, General Granger,"
Harry said out loud,
"you really should have waited to attack until after I'd fought General Malfoy. You might have been able to get all the survivors."
From somewhere came a girl's high-pitched laughter. Harry froze.
That wasn't Hermione.
And that was when the dreadful, eerie, cheerful chant began to rise, coming from all around them.
"Don't be frightened, don't be sad. We'll only hurt you if you're bad."
"Granger cheated!"
burst out Draco inside the shield.
"She woke up her soldiers! Why doesn't Professor Quirrell..."
"Let me guess,"
Harry said, the sickness already churning in his stomach. He really hated losing.
"It was a very easy battle, right? They dropped like flies."
"Yes,"
Draco said.
"We got them all on the first shot."
The look of horrified realization spread from Draco to the Chaos Legionnaires.
"No," Harry said. "We didn't."
Camouflaged forms were appearing from among the trees.
Allies,
Harry said.
"Allies," Draco said.
"Good,"
said General Granger's voice, and a spiral of green energy blazed out of the woods and shattered Draco's shield to splinters. General Granger surveyed the battlefield with a definite feeling of satisfaction. She was down to 9 Sunshine soldiers, but that was probably enough to handle the last survivor of the enemy forces, especially when Parvati and Antony and Ernie were already holding their wands on General Potter, whom she'd already taken alive. Well, conscious. It was bad, she knew, but she really, really, really wanted to gloat.
There's a trick, isn't there?
Said Harry, the strain showing in his voice.
There has to be some trick. You can't just turn into a perfect general. Not on top of everything else. You're not that Slytherin. You don't write creepy poetry. No one's that good at everything.
General Granger glanced around at her sunshine soldiers, and then looked back at Harry. Everyone was probably watching this on the screens outside. And General Granger said,
I can do anything if I study hard enough.
Oh, now that's just...
Somnium.
Harry slumped to the ground in mid-sentence.
Sunshine wins!
Intoned the huge voice of Professor Quirrell, seeming to come from everywhere and nowhere.
Niceness has triumphed!
Cried General Granger.
Hooray!
Shouted the Sunshine soldiers. Even the Gryffindor boys said it, and they said it with pride.
And... what's the moral of today's battle?
Said General Granger.
We can do anything if we study hard enough!
And the survivors of the Sunshine Regiment marched off toward the victory field, singing their marching song as they went. Don't be frightened, don't be sad. We'll only hurt you if you're bad, and send you to a home that's true. With new friends to watch over you, be sure to tell them you were sent by Granger's Sunshine Regiment.
Hello there, it's me, Jack Voraces. Thanks for listening so far. You reached the end of what I've recorded thus far. The next chapter will be published next Tuesday. I also want to invite you to my Discord server, where you can listen to live recordings. We have a good laugh, discuss the story, and decide on character voices together. Come and join! I really hope to see you there. You can find a link in the description, or just Google search Voraces Tavern Discord. You legends.
Chapter 31 Working in Groups, Part 2 Aftermaths. Harry paced backward and forward in his general's office, which made a wonderful room for pacing. It didn't have any other uses, as far as he could tell.
How? How?
Hermione shouldn't have won that battle. Not on her first try. Not when she wasn't at all violent by her nature, automatically being a great military commander, on top of everything else, was too much, even for her. Had she read about the tactic in a military history book? But it hadn't been just that one tactic. She had had her forces perfectly positioned to block any retreat. Her troops had been better coordinated than his, or Draco's. Had Professor Quirrell broken his promise not to help her? Had he given her the diary of General Tacitus or something? Harry was missing something here, something really important, and his mind went around and around in circles, and he still couldn't figure it out.
Finally, Harry sighed. He wasn't getting anywhere on this, and he had to go learn the breaking drill hex from Hermione or someone before the next battle. Professor Quirrell had explained to Harry, his voice amused, but with a sharp undertone of warning, that no magical items except the ones I give you included Muggle technology, no matter how much that wasn't magic. Plus, Harry also needed to figure out how to bring down Mr. Goyle next time. Battles counted for a lot of Quirrell points, if you were a general, and Harry needed to get cracking if he wanted to win Professor Quirrell's Christmas wish. In his private room at Slytherin, Draco Malfoy stared off into space, as though the wall in front of his desk was the most fascinating surface in the world. How? How? In retrospect, it had been an obvious sort of idea, as cunning plots went. But Granger wasn't supposed to be cunning. She had been too much of a Hufflepuff to use a simple strike hex. Had Professor Quirrell been advising her despite his promise, or... And then Draco finally did what he should have done much earlier. What he should have done after the first time he met with Granger. What Harry Potter had told him to do, trained him to do. And yet Harry had also warned Draco that it would take time to make his brain realize that the methods applied to real life. And Draco hadn't understood that until today. He could have avoided every single one of his mistakes if he'd just applied the things Harry had already told him. Draco said it out loud. I notice that I am confused.
Your strength as a rationalist is your ability to be more confused by fiction than by reality.
Draco was confused. Therefore, something he believed was fiction. Granger should not have been able to do all that. Therefore, she probably hadn't.
I promise not to help General Granger in any way that the two of you don't know about.
With sudden, horrified realization, Draco swept papers out of the way, hunting through the mess on his desk until he found it. And there it was. Right in the list of people and equipment assigned to each of the three armies.
Curse Professor Quirrell!
Draco had read it, and he still hadn't seen it. The afternoon sunlight poured down into the office of the Sunshine Regiment, illuminating General Granger in her chair, as though she glowed with a golden aura.
How long do you think it would take Malfoy to figure it out?
Said General Granger.
Not long, said Colonel Blaze Zabini. He may have already. How long will it take Potter to figure it out?
Forever, said General Granger. Unless Malfoy tells him, or one of his own soldiers realizes, Harry Potter just doesn't think like that.
Really? Said Captain Ernie Macmillan, looking up from one of the corner tables where he was being crushed at chess by Captain Ron Weasley. They brought back all the other chairs after Malfoy had left, of course.
I mean, it seems kind of obvious to me. Who would try to come up with all the ideas just by themselves?
Harry,
said Hermione, at exactly the same time as Zabini said,
Malfoy. Malfoy thinks he's way better than everyone else, said Zabini.
And Harry doesn't really see most other people like that,
said Hermione. It was kind of sad, actually. Harry had grown up very, very alone. It wasn't that he went around thinking in words that only geniuses had a right to exist. It just wouldn't occur to him that anyone in Hermione's army besides Hermione could have any good ideas.
"Anyhow," Hermione said, "Captains Goldstein and Weasley, you're on duty for thinking up strategic ideas for our next battle. Captains Macmillan and Macmillan and Bones, try to come up with some tactics we can use. Also, any training you think we should try. Oh, and congratulations on your marching song, Captain Goldstein. I think it was a big plus for our spirit de corps."
"What are you doing?" said Susan. "And Colonel Sabini?" Hermione stood up out of her chair, stretching.
"I'll try to figure out what Harry Potter is thinking, and Colonel Sabini will try to figure out what Draco Malfoy might do, and both of us will join you again after we come up with something. I'm going to walk while I think. Sabini, you want to come along?"
Yes, General," said Sabini stiffly.
It hadn't been meant as an order. Hermione sighed to herself a little. This was going to take some getting used to. And although Zabini's first idea had certainly worked, she wasn't quite sure that Professor Quirrell's, quote, "mixture of positive and negative incentives," unquote, would be enough to keep the Slytherin fully on her side until December, when traitors would be allowed for the first time. She still had no idea what she was going to do with Professor Quirrell's Christmas wish, either. Maybe she'd just ask Mandy if she wanted anything, when the time came around. Apologies for it being so short this week. It was a short chapter, but also I've got an awful lot going on. We're trying to finish Vancure the Dragon, Book 3, and Mother of Learning, Arc 2 recording starts very soon, so I've got to get all of that organised. Anyway, thank you for listening so far. Please do join the Discord, come and see all of the various audiobooks we produce for free, and for Audible, I'd love to see you there on a Monday evening. Thanks again. Laters. Chapter 32. Interlude. Personal Financial Management.
"But, Headmaster!"
Harry argued, some of his desperation leaking into his voice.
"Leaving all my assets in one undiversified vault full of gold coins? It's crazy, Headmaster. It's like, I don't know, doing transfiguration experiments without consulting a recognized authority. You just don't do that with money."
From the lined face of the old wizard, underneath a festive holiday hat like a catastrophic automobile collision between cars of green and red cloth, a grave, sad look peered out at Harry.
"I'm sorry, Harry," said Dumbledore. "And I do apologize, but allowing you control over your own finances would give you far too much independence of action."
Harry's mouth opened and no sound came out. He was literally speechless.
"I will permit you to withdraw 5 galleons for Christmas presents," said Dumbledore, "which is more than any boy your age should spend, but poses no threat, I think."
"I can't believe you just said that!"
The words burst out of Harry's mouth.
"You admit to being that manipulative?"
"Manipulative?" said the old wizard, smiling slightly. "No, manipulative would be if I did not admit it, or if I had some deeper motive behind the obvious. This
is quite straightforward, Harry. You are not yet ready to play the game, and it would be foolish to allow you thousands of galleons with which to upset the game board.
The bright hustle and bustle of Diagon Alley had increased by 100-fold and redoubled as Christmas approached. With all the shops shrouded in brilliant sorceries that flashed and sparked as though the season's spirit was about to blaze out of control and turn the whole area into a cheerful holiday crater. The streets were so crowded with witches and wizards in festive and loud clothing that your eyes were assaulted almost as severely as your ears, and it was clear, from the bewildering variety of the shoppers, that Diagon Alley was considered an international attraction. There were witches wrapped in giant swathes of cloth like toweled mummies, and wizards in formal top hats and bathrobes, and young children barely past toddling age who were decorated with lights that blazed almost as brightly as the shops themselves, as their parents took them hand in hand through that magical wonderland and let them shriek to their hearts' content. It was the season to be merry. And, in the midst of all that light and cheer, a note of blackest night. A cold, dark atmosphere that cleared a few precious paces of distance even in the midst of all that crush.
No!
Said Professor Quirrell, with a look of grim revulsion, like he'd just bitten into food that not only tasted horrible, but was morally repugnant to boot. It was the sort of grim face an ordinary person might make after biting into a meat pie and discovering that it was rotten and had been made from kittens.
"Oh, come on," Harry said. "You must have some ideas."
"Mr. Potter,"
Professor Quirrell said, his lips set in a thin line,
"I agreed to act as your adult guardian on this expedition. I did not agree to advise you on your choice of presents. I don't do Christmas, Mr. Potter."
"How about Newtonmas?" Harry said brightly. "Isaac Newton actually was born on December 25th, unlike some other historical figures I could name."
This failed to impress Professor Quirrell.
Look, said Harry, "I'm sorry, but I've got to do something special for Fred and George, and I've got no idea of my options."
Professor Quirrell made a thoughtful humming sound.
You could ask which family members they most dislike, and then hire an assassin. I know someone from a certain government in exile who is quite competent, and he would give you a discount on multiple Weasleys."
"This Christmas,"
Harry said, dropping his voice into a lower register,
"give your friends the gift of death."
That made Professor Quirrell smile. It went all the way to his eyes.
Well, said Harry, at least you didn't suggest getting them a pet rat.
Harry's mouth snapped shut, and he was regretting the words almost as soon as they were out of his mouth.
"Pardon me," said Professor Quirrell.
Nothing,
Harry said at once.
A long, dumb story.
And telling it seemed wrong, somehow. Maybe because Harry was afraid Professor Quirrell would have laughed, even if Bill Weasley hadn't been cured and everything put back to right. And where had Professor Quirrell been that he'd never heard the story? Harry had gotten the impression that everyone in Magical Britain knew.
Look, said Harry, I'm trying to solidify their loyalty to me. You know, make the Weasley twins my minions,
like the old saying goes, a friend isn't someone you use once and then throw away. A friend is someone you use over and over again. Fred and George are two of the most useful friends I have in Hogwarts, Professor Quirrell, and I plan to use them over and over again. So if you'd help me be Slytherin here and suggest something they might be very grateful for...
Harry's voice trailed off invitingly. You just had to pitch these things the right way. They walked on for a good way before Professor Quirrell spoke again, his voice practically dripping with distaste.
The Weasley twins are using second-hand wands, Mr. Potter. They would be reminded of your generosity with every charm they cast.
Harry clapped his hands together in involuntary excitement.
Just put the money on the account at Ollivander's and tell Mr. Ollivander to never refund it. No, better yet, to send it to Lucius Malfoy if the Weasley twins didn't show up before the start of their next school year.
That's brilliant, Professor.
Professor Quirrell did not look like he appreciated the compliment.
I suppose I can tolerate Christmas in that spirit, Mr. Potter, though only barely.
Then he smiled slightly.
Of course, that will cost you 14 galleons, and you only have 5.
5 galleons,
Harry said with a sniff of outrage.
Just who does the headmaster think he's dealing with, anyway?
I think, said Professor Quirrell, that it simply did not occur to him to fear the consequences if you turned your ingenuity to the task of obtaining funds. Though you were wise to lose, rather than making it an explicit threat. Out of curiosity, Mr. Potter, what would you have done if I hadn't turned away in boredom while you, in a fit of childish pique, counted out 5 galleons worth of knuts?
Well, the easiest way would have been to borrow money from Draco Malfoy, said Harry.
Professor Quirrell chuckled briefly.
Seriously, Mr. Potter?
Duly noted.
Probably. I'd have done a few celebrity appearances. I wouldn't resort to anything economically disruptive, just for spending money.
Harry had checked, and he would be allowed to keep the time-turner while he went home for the holidays, so that his sleep cycle didn't start to rotate. But then it was also possible that someone kept an eye out for magical day traders. The gold and silver trick would have taken work on the Muggle end, and seed funding, and the goblins might have gotten suspicious after the first cycle. And starting a real bank would be a lot of work. Harry hadn't quite worked out any money-making methods that were fast, and certain, and safe, so he'd been very glad when Professor Quirrell had turned out to be so easily fooled.
I do hope those 5 galleons will be enough to last, since you counted them so carefully, said Professor Quirrell. I doubt the headmaster shall be so eager to entrust me with your vault key a second time, once he discovers I've been tricked.
I'm sure you did your best,
Harry said with deep gratitude.
Do you need any assistance finding a safe place to store all those knuts, Mr. Potter?
Well, sort of, said Harry. Do you know of any good investment opportunities, Professor Quirrell?
And the two of them walked on, in their tiny sphere of silence and isolation, through the brilliant and bustling crowds. And, if you looked carefully, you would see that where they went, leafy boughs faded, and flowers withered, and children's toys that played cheerful bells changed to lower and more ominous notes. Harry did notice, but he didn't say anything, just smiled a little to himself. Everyone had their own way of celebrating the holidays, and the Grinch was as much a part of Christmas as Santa. Chapter 33 Coordination Problems, Part 1 The terrifying part was how fast the whole thing had spiraled out of control.
"Elvis!"
Minerva said, not even trying to keep the worry out of her voice as the two of them entered the Great Hall.
"Something is to be done!"
The atmosphere at Hogwarts before Yuletide was usually bright and cheerful. The Great Hall had already been decorated in green and red, after a Slytherin and a Gryffindor whose Yule wedding had become a symbol of friendship transcending houses and allegiances, a tradition almost as ancient as Hogwarts itself, and which had even spread to Muggle countries. Now, the students eating dinner were glancing nervously over their shoulders, or sending vicious glares at other tables, or, at some tables, arguing heatedly. You could have described the atmosphere as tense, perhaps. But the phrase coming to Minerva's mind was fifth degree of caution. Take a school, into four houses divided, now into each year, add three armies at war. And the partisanship of Dragon and Sunshine and Chaos had spread beyond the first years. They had become the armies for those who had no armies. The students were wearing armbands with insignia of fire, or smile, or upraised hand, and hexing each other in the corridors. All three first-year generals had told them to stop. Even Draco Malfoy had heard her out and then nodded grimly, but their supposed followers hadn't listened. Dumbledore gazed out at the tables with a distant look.
"In every city,"
the old wizard quoted softly,
"the population has been divided for a long time past into the blue and the green factions, and they fight against their opponents, knowing not for what end they imperil themselves. So there grows up in them against their fellow men a hostility which has no cause, and at no time does it cease or disappear. For it gives place neither to the ties of marriage, nor of relationship, nor of friendship. And the case is the same, even though those who differ with respect to these colours be brother or any other kin. I, for my part, am unable to call this anything except a disease of the soul."
"I'm sorry," said Minerva. "I don't..."
"Procopius," said Dumbledore. "They took their chariot racing very seriously in the Roman Empire. Yes, Minerva, I agree that something must be done."
"Soon,"
Minerva said, her voice lowering even further.
"Elvis, I think it must be done before Saturday."
On Sunday, most students would leave Hogwarts to stay the holiday with their families. Saturday, then, was the final battle of the three first-year armies that would determine the awarding of Professor Quirrell's thrice-cursed Christmas wish. Dumbledore glanced over at her, studying her gravely.
"You fear that the explosion will come then, and someone will be hurt?"
Minerva nodded.
and that Professor Quirrell will be blamed."
Minerva nodded again, her face tight. She had long since become wise in the ways that defense professors were fired.
"Hilbus,"
Minerva said,
"we cannot lose Professor Quirrell. No, we cannot. If he but stays through January, our fifth years will pass their OWLs. If he stays through March, our seventh years will pass their NEWTs. He's remedying years of neglect in months. A whole generation will grow up able to defend themselves in spite of the Dark Lord's curse. You must stop the battle, Elvis. Ban these armies now."
"I'm not sure the defense professor would take that kindly,"
said Dumbledore, glancing toward the head table where Quirrell was drooling into his soup.
"He did seem most attached to his armies, though when I agreed, I thought there would be four in each year."
The old wizard sighed.
"A clever man, probably with the best of intentions, but perhaps not clever enough, I fear. And to ban the armies might also trigger the explosion."
"But then, Elvis, what will you do?"
The old wizard favoured her with a benign smile.
"Why, I shall plot, of course. It's the new fashion in Hogwarts."
And they had come too close to the head table for Minerva to say anything more. The terrifying part was how fast the whole thing had spiraled out of control. The first battle in December had been messy, or so Draco had heard. The second battle had been deranged, and the next one would be worse, unless the three of them together succeeded in their last desperate attempt to stop it.
"Professor Quirrell, this is insanity," Draco said flatly. "This isn't Slytherin any more. It's just—"
Draco was at a loss for words. He waved his hands helplessly.
"You can't possibly do any real plots with all this stuff going on. Last battle, one of my soldiers faked his own suicide. We have Hufflepuffs trying to plot, and they think they can, but they can't. Things just happen at random now. It doesn't have anything to do with who's cleverest or which army fights best. It's—"
He couldn't even describe it.
"I agree with Mr. Malfoy,"
said Granger in the tones of someone who hadn't ever expected to hear herself saying those words.
"Allowing traitors isn't working, Professor Quirrell."
Draco had tried forbidding anyone in his army to plot except him. And that had just driven the plots underground. No one wanted to be left out when the soldiers in other armies got to plot. After miserably losing their last battle, he had finally given in and revoked his decree. But by then his soldiers had already started setting their own personal plans in motion, without any sort of central coordination. After being told all the plans, or what his soldiers claimed were their plans, Draco had tried to sketch a plot to win the final battle. It had required considerably more than three different things to go right, and Draco had used Incendio on the paper and Everto to vanish the ashes, because if Father had seen it, he would have been disowned. Professor Quirrell's eyelids were half-closed, his chin resting on his hands as he leaned forward onto his desk.
"And you, Mr. Potter," said the defense professor, "are you likewise in agreement?"
All we need to do is shoot Franz Ferdinand, and we could start World War I, said Harry. It's gone to complete chaos. I'm all for it.
Harry!
Said Draco in utter shock. He didn't even realize until a second later that he'd said it at the exact same time, and in exactly the same tone of indignation as Granger. Granger shot him a startled glance, and Draco carefully kept his face neutral. Oops.
That's right, said Harry. I'm betraying you, both of you, again!
Professor Quirrell was smiling thinly, though his eyes were still half closed.
And why is that, Mr. Potter?
Because I think I can cope with the chaos better than Miss Granger or Mr. Malfoy,
said the traitor.
Our way is a zero-sum game, and it doesn't matter whether it's easy or hard in an absolute sense, only who does better or worse.
Harry Potter was learning far too fast. Professor Quirrell's eyes moved beneath their lids to regard Draco, and then Granger.
In truth, Mr. Malfoy, Miss Granger, I simply could not live with myself if I shut down the grand debacle before its climax. One of your soldiers has even become a quadruple agent.
Quadruple? Said Granger.
But there's only three sides in the war.
Yes, said Professor Quirrell. You'd think that, wouldn't you? I am not sure that there has ever in history been a quadruple agent, or any army with such a high fraction of real and pretend traitors. We are exploring new realms, Miss Granger, and we cannot turn back now.
Draco left the defense professor's office with his teeth gritted hard against each other, and Granger looking even more annoyed beside him.
I can't believe you did that, Harry, said Granger.
Sorry,
Harry said, not sounding sorry at all, his lips curved up in a merry smile of evil.
Remember, Hermione, it is just a game, and why should generals like us be the only ones who get to plot? And besides, what are the two of you going to do about it? Team up against me?
Draco traded glances with Granger, knowing that his own face was as tight as hers. Harry had been relying, more and more openly, and gloatingly, on Draco's refusal to make common cause with a mudblood girl. And Draco was beginning to get sick of having that used against him. If this kept up much longer, he was going to ally with Granger, just to crush Harry Potter, and see how much the son of a mudblood liked that. The terrifying part was how fast the whole thing had spiraled out of control. Hermione stared at the parchment Zabini had given her, feeling utterly and completely helpless. There were names, and lines connecting the names to other names, and some of the lines were in different colours, and...
Tell me, said General Granger, is there anyone in my army who isn't a spy?
The two of them weren't in the office, but in another deserted classroom, and they were alone because Colonel Zabini had said it was now nearly certain that at least one of the captains was a traitor. Probably Captain Goldstein, but Zabini didn't know for sure. Her question had put an ironic smile on the young Slytherin's face. Blaze Zabini always seemed a little disdainful of her, but he didn't seem to actively dislike her. Nothing like the derision he held for Draco Malfoy, or the resentment he had developed for Harry Potter. She had worried at first about Zabini betraying her, but the boy seemed desperate to show that the other two generals were no better than him. And Hermione thought that, while Zabini would probably be happy to sell her out to anyone else, he'd never let Malfoy or Harry win.
"Most of your soldiers are still loyal to you, I'm pretty sure," said Zabini. "It's just that no one wants to be left out of the fun."
The scornful look on the Slytherin's face made it clear what he thought of people who didn't take plotting seriously.
"So they think they can be double agents and secretly work for our side while pretending to betray us."
"And that would also go for anyone in the other armies who says they want to be our spy?"
Hermione said carefully. The young Slytherin shrugged.
"I think I did a good job of telling which ones really want to sell out Malfoy. I'm not sure anyone really wants to sell out Potter to you. But Knott is a sure bet for betraying Potter to Malfoy, and since I had Endwhistle approach him, supposedly on behalf of Malfoy, and Endwhistle really reports to us, that's almost as good."
Hermione closed her eyes for a moment.
"We're going to lose, aren't we?"
"Look,"
Zabini said patiently,
"you're in the lead right now on Quirrell points. We just have to not lose this last battle completely, and you'll have enough Quirrell points to win the Christmas wish."
Professor Quirrell had announced that the final battle would operate on a formal scoring system, which he'd been asked to do to avoid recriminations afterward. Each time you shot someone, the general of your army got 2 Quirrell points. A gong would ring through the battle area. They didn't know yet where they would be fighting, though Hermione was hoping for the forest again, where Sunshine did well, and its pitch would tell which army had won the points. And if anyone was faking being hit, the gong would ring out anyway, and then a double gong would ring later, after no fixed time, to hail the retraction. And if you called the name for an army, cried, "For Sunshine," or "For Chaos," or "For Dragon," it switched your allegiance to that army. Even Hermione had been able to see the flaw in that set of rules. But Professor Quirrell had gone on to announce that if you'd been originally assigned to Sunshine, nobody could shoot you in the name of Sunshine. Or rather, they could, but then Sunshine lost a single Quirrell point, symbolized by a triple gong. That prevented you from shooting your own soldiers for points and discouraged suiciding before the enemy got you. But you could still shoot spies if you had to. Right now, Hermione had 244 Quirrell points, and Malfoy had 219, and Harry had 221. And there were 24 soldiers in each army.
"So we fight carefully,"
Hermione said,
"and just try not to lose too badly."
"No,"
said Zabini. The young Slytherin's face was now serious.
"The problem is, Malfoy and Potter both know that the only way to win is to combine and crush us, then fight it out on their own. So, here's what I think we should do."
Hermione left the classroom in something of a daze. Zabini's plan hadn't been the obvious one. It had been strange and complicated and layered, and the sort of thing she would have expected Harry to come up with, not Zabini. It felt wrong just for her to be able to understand a plan like that. Young girls shouldn't be able to understand plans like that. The hat would have sorted her into Slytherin, if it had seen that she could understand plans like that. The awesome thing was how fast he'd been able to escalate the chaos once he'd started doing it deliberately. Harry sat in his office. He'd been given the authority to order furniture from the house elves, so he had ordered a throne, and curtains in a black and crimson pattern. Scarlet light like blood mixed with shadow poured over the floor. Something in Harry felt like he'd finally come home. Before him stood the four lieutenants of chaos, his most trusted minions, one of whom was a traitor. This was what life should be like.
"We are gathered," said Harry.
"Let chaos reign,"
chorused his four lieutenants.
"My hovercraft is full of eels," said Harry.
"I will not buy this record, it is scratched,"
chorused his four lieutenants.
"All mimsy were the Borogroves."
"And the Mome Rats outgrabe."
That concluded the formalities.
"How goes the confusion?"
Harry said in a dry whisper, like Emperor Palpatine.
"It goes, well, general chaos,"
said Neville in the tone he always used for military matters, a tone so deep that the boy often had to stop and cough. The chaotic lieutenant was neatly dressed in his black school robes, trimmed in the yellow of Hufflepuff House, and his hair was parted and combed in the usual look for an earnest young boy. Harry had liked the incongruity better than any of the cloaks they'd tried.
"Our legionnaires have begun 5 new plots since yesterday evening,"
Harry smiled evilly.
"Do any of them have a chance of working?"
"I don't think so,"
said Neville of Chaos.
"Here's the report."
"Excellent,"
said Harry, and laughed chillingly as he took the parchment from Neville's hand, trying his best to make it sound like he was choking on dust. That brought the total to 60. Let Draco try to handle that. Let him try. And as for Blaze Zabini, Harry laughed again, and this time it didn't even take an effort to sound evil. He really needed to borrow someone's pet Neasel for his staff meetings, so he'd have a cat to stroke while he did this.
"Can the Legion start making plots now?"
said Finnegan of Chaos.
"I mean, don't we have enough already?"
"No,"
Harry said flatly.
"We can never have enough plots."
Professor Quirrell had put it perfectly. They were pushing the boundaries further, perhaps than they had ever been pushed. And Harry wouldn't have been able to live with himself if he'd turned back now. There came a knock at the door.
"That will be the dragon, General,"
Harry said, smiling with evil prescience.
"He arrives precisely as I expected. Do show him in, and yourselves out."
And the four lieutenants of chaos shuffled out, casting dark looks at Draco as the enemy general entered into Harry's secret lair. If he wasn't allowed to do this when he was older, Harry was just going to stay 11 forever. The sun was dripping through the red curtains, sending rays of blood dancing across the floor from behind Harry Potter's grown-up-sized cushioned chair, which he'd covered in gold and silver glitter and insisted on referring to as his throne. Draco was beginning to feel a lot more confident that he'd done the right thing in deciding to overthrow Harry Potter before he could take over the world. Draco couldn't even imagine what it would be like to live under his rule.
"Good evening, Dragon General,"
said Harry Potter in a chill whisper.
"You have arrived, just as I expected."
This was not surprising, considering that Draco and Harry had agreed on the meeting time in advance.
And it also wasn't evening, but now Draco knew better than to say anything.
General Potter,
Draco said with as much dignity as he could manage,
you know that our two armies have to work together for either of us to win Professor Quirrell's wish, right?
Yes,
hissed Harry, like the boy thought he was a parcel mouth.
We must cooperate to destroy Sunshine, and only then fight it out between us. But if one of us betrays the other early on, that one could gain an advantage in the later fight. And the Sunshine General, who knows all this, will try to trick each of us into thinking the other has betrayed them. And you and I, who know that, we'll be tempted to betray the other and pretend that it is Granger's trickery. And Granger knows that as well.
Draco nodded. That much was obvious.
And both of us only want to win, and there's no one else who'll punish either of us if we defect.
Precisely,
said Harry Potter, his face now turning serious.
We are faced with a true prisoner's dilemma.
The prisoner's dilemma, according to Harry's teaching, ran thus. Two prisoners had been locked in separate cells. There was evidence against each prisoner, but only minor evidence, enough for a prison sentence of 2 years apiece. Each prisoner could opt to defect, betray